Today at Reader's Corner, Stephanie Witt, co-editor of Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude, Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With 70% of its land owned by the federal government, the Great Basin is known as America's last frontier. It's home to ghost towns, endless sagebrush, and secretive government test sites. Paradoxically, the Great Basin also is the fastest-growing urban region in the United States. Thanks to the cities of Boise, Salt Lake City, Reno, and Las Vegas that perch on its rim. The Great Basin's explosive growth has raised pressing economic and environmental questions as larger communities compete for the desert's dwindling water resources and independent ranchers clash with government agencies looking to regulate and preserve this endangered ecosystem. A new book titled Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude, Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin explores the region's ecological and political history and the challenges it now faces. Today's guest, Stephanie Witt, co-edited the book with Dennis R. Judd, a political science professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and she is also among the book's contributing writers. Dr. Witt is director of the Applied Research Center at Boise State and a professor in the School of Public Service. Scholars affiliated with a number of universities, including several from Boise State, contributed chapters to this book. Dr. Witt joins us in the studio for this interview. Stephanie Witt, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's kick off with the most obvious question. What is the Great Basin? What makes it so unique? How do you define it?
Well, the geologists and the hydrologists will define it as the bowl-shaped geological formation in the inland west where the rivers don't drain to the sea. So it's like a bowl. And if you think of a circle from the Wasatch Mountains on Salt Lake's eastern border and draw a circle around the Owyhee Mountains and down to Las Vegas in that sort of a way, you see the area where the rivers end in sinks or disappear into the ground and don't make it to the ocean.
So you use a term like the last frontier to describe the Great Basin. What do you mean by that?
Well, for a long time in our nation's development, the Great Basin was sort of like a rock in the middle of the stream. As immigrants streamed towards the west, they went on either side to get around the Great Basin, either north or south of it. But very few people stopped there because it was such a desolate place. In fact, when you read the historical accounts and the early settlers, it's as if people were falling all over themselves to come up with the most desolate, bleak-sounding descriptions of this place that they were trying to get through in order to get to California or Oregon. Mm-hmm. So it was a very empty place for the longest time and one of the last major areas in the United States to infill with urban growth.
You know, it's interesting. When we fly into Boise, most of us tend to look toward the western edge of the Rockies, the foothills behind the city of Boise, as we call them. We seldom look the other direction to the Owyhees, just because they are so barren and relatively desolate compared to the rest of the state. How do the Owyhees characterize the Great Basin? And I might add, by the way, that one of our faculty, John Beter, in the history department, has written a book called Showdown in the Big Quiet, Land, Myth, and Government in the American West. But getting back to the point here, let's talk for a moment about how the Owyhees really do sum up what we think of when we define the Great Basin Desert.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind for me is that there are so many communities that were attempted to be created in the Owyhees that didn't succeed, either because it was so rugged and desolate. And, of course, there's the limitation of water in this arid desert that we're in. And so given that homesteading and settlement failed in a great portion of the Great Basin, that land was retained by the federal government, and now we see no settlement in such a large swath because it's, of course, public land and not open to settlement.
So who were the first to settle in the Great Basin?
Well, of course, there were, you know, the indigenous peoples were here first, of course, and then as European settlers from North America came streaming in. We saw in Utah, of course, the Mormon Church, the LDS settlers were among the first to really populate that portion of the basin. The rest of the Great Basin is really mostly attached to extraction, you know, mining, ranching, and that sort of thing. And so you had two really different kinds of settlement going on in the Wasatch Front, where the church was primarily organizing everyone and turning that into an irrigated area where you could put a lot of people. And the mining claims in the rest of the Great Basin had a different pattern, different culture, obviously, and a different historical pattern. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that reminds me of the fact that somewhere in your book, one of your authors referred to the communitarian impulse. And they were describing the fact that, as you just said, the Mormons who came to settle gathered in a collective fashion to work together. Meanwhile, some of the other settlers were coming out here, hey, I'm on my own, don't bother me, I don't want anything to do with anybody. And it sets up kind of a contrast when it comes to the way this part of the West was settled, doesn't it?
It does. Although I would point out, I think that it actually took a communitarian effort to get any of these parts of the areas, either in the hydraulic Great Basin or what we're calling the Great Basin Desert that extends up into the Snake River Valley, to get that settled at all. You know, for example, the settlement in the Boise Valley, the Treasure Valley, was relatively sparse until the federal government established the dams and the canals that led to irrigation and the advancement of agriculture and larger urban areas. So if you look at each of those four cities on the rim of the Great Basin, Boise, Reno, Salt Lake, and Las Vegas, each of them almost has a foot in another kind of ecosystem where they can access the water necessary to have that many people in one place. Here in Boise, of course, we have the Lucky Peak and Arrow Rock system of an Anderson Dam, you know, for our water. The same is true in terms of a federally built dam, you know, in the vicinity of these other cities. And that's what makes it possible to have that many people in one place.
And that's kind of an interesting point in itself, because one of the themes running through the modern day West and the modern day Great Basin is the politics of hating the federal government. The folks getting all the news coverage are hating the federal government. And yet it's the federal government that built this basin or makes it work in many ways.
Yeah, that was part of what really drew us to the region to write about, because there's this ambivalence about the necessary presence of the federal government. The federal government is sort of this shadow lurking behind everything, really. They own all the land, a lot of the infrastructure that's here, the freeways, the military bases, the test sites, the dams. It all has the fingerprints of the federal government. But there's a lot of resentment about that. And I think it's our attachment in part to the mythology that a rugged individualist really can make it on their own out here. And in some cases, of course, that's true. But in many cases, we're talking about people who are building on the foundation of something that was created by government. In fact, in some of the most remote counties in the Great Basin area, if you look at where the jobs are there, that some of them have upwards of 25, 30, 40% of the jobs in their county are government jobs. In other words, there wouldn't be anything there if there wasn't government almost. And so we have this ambivalence about it. That's why I like in part the title we chose for one of my chapters, which is Go Away Closer. Right. You know, yeah,
right,
you know, like
right.
Go away, but stay near because I need the money and I need your support.
So for a long time anyway, the Great Basin was really overlooked by the so-called tourism industry, I think it's fair to say. But the art world didn't have any trouble finding it. Tell us about that.
Well, you're referencing Todd Shallett's excellent chapter on Framing the Empty, and he traces the history of the way that artists have portrayed the Great Basin. And early artists wanted to portray come here and make the desert into paradise kind of things, you know. So there were a lot of paintings of crops growing, orderly farmsteads, you know, with, you know, the chickens and the picket fence and all this stuff.
Right.
And it looked like we could make a garden out of the desert. But as we got into the 20th century, and by the way, we're way out of my league here on art history, but this is but I have read the chapter. As we got into the 20th century, many more artists turned to the more desolate and bleak aspects of the parts of the Great Basin that were, you know, nuclear test sites and the kind of dark legacy of the atomic testing.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. I'm talking today with Stephanie Witt about the Great Basin and the challenges it faces. Dr. Witt edited a new book, Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude. She is a professor of public policy administration here at Boise State. So tell us a little bit about the fast-growing urban side of this. I mean, I'm sitting here talking about the Owyhees, where it's hard to throw a stone somewhere and hit somebody. But on the other hand, you've got Las Vegas, and you've got Salt Lake and Boise and Reno. And Vegas especially is the most fascinating for me. You go down to Vegas these days, and there at the Bellagio is this monstrous reflecting pool and all these water gimmicks that they're throwing water into the air and it's evaporating. And you'd never dream in a million years that you're in the middle of or around the Great Basin where water is as scarce as it is. What's the future for Las Vegas? And I think you talk about this in the readings anyway.
Yeah, well, there's a great chapter on Las Vegas by Elizabeth Raymond, who's an excellent historian from the University of Nevada, Reno. We didn't know her, but we had read one of her chapters in a book called Many Wests, and we thought, we've got to get this person. She's great, and she writes about the history of Las Vegas. And the title of her chapter is The Persistent Possibility of Failure, noting that it kind of seems like Las Vegas has been teetering on the edge of way too much of something and going to fall off the edge the whole time. And they always seem to be able to reimagine its purpose, reimagine its economy in a way that it keeps on going. Now, I will say I've done a lot of interviews with elected officials in Clark County, Nevada, and they insist that the Strip, the Las Vegas Strip, is actually among the world's best recyclers of water, and they maintain that there's not that much of a net loss in water. Now, that seems crazy to me on the face of it, but I think that's part of the allure. Come here to this impossible thing. You know, here on this one road, we're going to replicate the pyramids, the Eiffel Tower, circus, whatever. You know, come here and something crazy is going to happen. And obviously they've been able to make that work economically, although I think the danger there is you've got all your eggs in that one kind of basket. And so when the economy takes an extreme reversal like it did in 2008 and as the housing bubble burst, then you've got a problem because you're really dependent on people traveling to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the relationship between these four cities we've mentioned that are in the Great Basin and state governments – it looks to me like Boise and Reno are probably fairly similar, but Vegas and Salt Lake are very different. And I'm just trying to get at how the politics of the state works when it comes to who really controls the decisions and what that's going to say about the future. In Salt Lake and in Vegas, you would think the state might be a little more concerned about those two cities, given the huge economic engines they are for the state. Meanwhile, here in Boise and in Reno, but I can't speak for Reno, I'll just stick with Boise, as I visit the legislature every year, it's abundantly clear that all the power lies outside the city in the region of Boise, and that's how decisions are made. When it comes to water scarcity and some of the tough decisions that will have to be made sooner or later, that seems to be problematical for this region.
In my opinion, I think that Nevada and Idaho have some similarities there. Their legislatures are more dominated by the rural interests in the far-flung counties. One of the Clark County commissioners I interviewed told me that they call them the rurals. The rurals in Nevada, you know, against the two populous counties where I think, you know, maybe as many as 75% of all the people in Nevada are in those two, are either in Washoe County with Reno or Clark County with Las Vegas. Nevada and Idaho seem similar to me in that there seems to be opposition between the rest of the state versus the big places. Now, in Nevada, that got very real, where the Nevada state legislature actually took locally collected tax revenues from Washoe and Clark County and used it to patch the state budget hole, right? So, you know, when you take tens of millions of dollars out of a city's budget and a county's budget and say, we need this over here to fix the state budget, as the county commissioner from there that I interviewed said, we're swimming in the same revenue stream and they're taking it. They're making it harder for us. It eventually ended at the Nevada Supreme Court, where the Nevada Supreme Court said you can't do that. But that was unfortunately a mechanism that several Western states resorted to during the middle of the recession.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the federal land ownership and the conflicts that it brings about. First of all, tell us about how much land we're talking about is federally owned in each of these states.
Well, it's a lot. I believe it's about 70% of the Great Basin itself is comprised of federal land, and So most of that, of course, is the state of Nevada. So the state of Nevada has very little public land relative to that. Idaho's percentage of public land, I believe, is around 65%. So portions of the Great Basin extend into Oregon, where I believe maybe that's 43% is public land, including all the entities, and a little bit of the Owens Valley in California is the Great Basin Desert. So you have great expanses of BLM land.
Bureau of Land Management.
The Bureau of Land Management, that's right, mostly rangeland. Some has cattle on it. Sometimes it's flat. Sometimes it's mountainous, you know, that kind of thing. There's also U.S. Forest Service land in Nevada and in parts of Idaho, of course, and a national park in the Great Basin National Park. And then there are, of course, a lot of federally owned lands that have to do with the military, testing sites, military bases, waste storage.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you mentioned cattle and you mentioned land. The only other word missing there is grazing.
Yes.
And grazing is the issue that seems to ignite the tempers and flares up folks depending on what side of it you're on. But especially if you're a rancher in the West, that has become a really big issue. Could you just walk us through what you see the challenges are there? And I mean, for one thing, I think I read somewhere in these readings that grazing fees themselves haven't changed for years and they're pretty low. Now, again, I'm looking at that as somebody who lives in Boise, and I'm sure somebody out there with cattle on the range may look at it a lot differently.
Well, that's true. And I'm certainly no rancher, but we have an entire sector of the economy that's important to many of these smaller communities throughout the Great Basin based on ranching, running cattle. And the fees are significantly lower than they might have been had they been keeping track with inflation, right? So the perception is that we're giving these owners of the cattle maybe too much of a break to run the cattle on the land. I don't think anyone cares so much about the price break, but there are, of course, environmental costs to having the cattle running on the land. There are concerns about stream bed destruction and erosion and, destruction of the natural grasses, overgrazing, for example, that kind of thing, that might hurt the other parts of the ecosystem that are sensitive to disturbances like that. And so a lot of environmental groups have presented challenges to how many cows, how much they're paying, how often they're there, that kind of thing, to try to decrease the environmental hazards. And it's more than just should the cattlemen get to do what they want to do or the environmentalists get to do what they want to do. But to the people living in those communities that are reliant on the jobs and the money from the jobs that are created by ranching and cattle, they see a way of life under threat. And for the last couple generations, that's how they've been making their living. So you're sort of pitting the way of life of these small communities against the faraway federal government with their land management decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, this really all came to a head on a national level when this rancher from Nevada, Cliven Bundy, really decided to take on the federal government. Maybe you might explain at least what happened there. What's the basis for this this volatile set of issues surrounding Mr. Bundy and the BLM?
My understanding is that he's been in violation of BLM rules about grazing for a number of years, maybe as many as 20 years. And he doesn't want to remove his cattle from lands to which he has no legal right to have them there, right? He doesn't want to move them. And so when in April 2014, when BLM officers moved in to try to move these cattle off of the parts of the public lands that he did not have legal access to, they were confronted by armed supporters of Bundy. And I think to diffuse the situation, I mean, I can't speak to the motives of the BLM, but it appeared that in order to avoid some kind of shootout, they backed off. My understanding is maybe it's still at a standstill.
Mm-hmm. So the Bundy case is really tied to the so-called county supremacy movement.
Yeah.
Could you explain what that is in law, or not in law, but what they think it is in law? And I'm just curious whether the Supreme Court will ever get a case like that.
Well, I doubt it. The county supremacy movement is really a subset of what we usually call the Sagebrush Rebellion, you know, the wave after wave of discontent from Western land users and extraction mining folks, cattle, foresters, that sort of thing, who are resistant to changes in federal land management policy that are trending towards the more environmental protection direction, right? So Bruce Babbitt, the former Secretary of Interior, once called it a kabuki drama that we have to go through every so many years where the states and local governments and ranchers and miners and foresters get together in outrage against federal land management decisions and try to impact them. And so we've seen several waves of the county supremacy movement and the Sagebrush Rebellion. These ordinances were passed by county commissioners who were trying to assert sovereignty over the public lands in their county, which is, of course, as any Political Science 101 student would tell you, a non-starter with the courts. The county can't override the federal government. But it was a great way, through symbolic politics, to say, we're not happy with the direction this is going. This is devastating to us economically, and we want a seat at the table. And even though I think some of the true believers would disagree, I think that the federal land management agencies have made some attempts to increase collaborative efforts to have the local governments and local citizens at the table when they're making these management plans for the resources.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Witt about a new book, Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude: Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin. Dr. Witt edited the book, and she also contributed several chapters. As we look into the future, what are the biggest environmental threats the Great Basin faces?
Well, it's actually a pretty fragile area environmentally, apparently. And so water is an enormous question. With a big metropolitan area like Las Vegas, Clark County, Nevada is now around 2 million people. And they need a lot of water, and the region has been in a persistent drought for many years. And the biggest danger sign is that Lake Mead, the reservoir at Las Vegas, is dropping precipitously. And in fact, I make visits to Clark County, and you go out to near Mesquite, and you can see there are homes that were built with a dock, meaning they thought that they were on the waterfront of Lake Mead, and that water has retreated so far that you can't even see it on the distant horizon, and those homes are just sitting on dry ground with a dock laying in the dust. So the water intake is getting close to below the dam intake, and that's bad. I think that's called a dead pool. So the city of Las Vegas's pipe to suck the water out of Lake Mead, the original one is now above the waterline. They've had to construct another one. And, of course, then they're turning their attention to these areas north in the middle of Nevada, to the valleys that might have some underwater aquifer and runoff that they can get as sort of a water grab to allow Las Vegas and the metropolitan users of the water to have enough to get by.
That sounds like a prescription for a civil war in Nevada if there ever was one.
It does. Well, I think what scares people is it sounds a lot like what happened to the Owens Valley in California, you know, in the early 1900s when the city of Los Angeles secured all the water rights and pretty much left it as a desert there in the Owens Valley, the Owens River down to a trickle. Mm-hmm. So there is some concern about that. And, of course, it brings in an interstate conflict because some of the aquifer that Las Vegas is hoping to tap into actually extends under the state of Utah. The two states spent many years negotiating an interstate compact about the use of that water. But in the end, Utah's governor became concerned that too much water was going to be taken from underneath the Utah side of the border, and the compact fell apart.
I mentioned earlier the lopsided control that rural areas tend to have in the Great Basin area over the cities. And I ran across these Great Basin surveys from 1998 and 2011 that were done. And, I mean, they're really pretty amazing. In 1998, 80.5% of the people, and in 2011, 89.7% of the respondents agreed with the statement, humans have an ethical obligation to protect plant and animal species. Those are pretty astounding numbers, aren't they?
Well, they are, and I think it goes to show that when we talk about these land management conflicts, I think we oversimplify it because we kind of demonize all of the people in the smaller communities or the rural areas to say, oh, they just want to destroy the environment, you know, with whatever they're doing. I've never found that to be the case, and I've done two separate sets of surveys with county officials from rural areas throughout the West, and I think they care about the environment just as much as the urbanites do. It is expressed differently, and it leads to different policy concerns. But I don't think the issue is that they don't care. They're living there. That's their, you know, what one of the people told me in Clark County, Idaho, when I was doing the interviewing, is she said, we live this every day. This public land stuff, this is where we live. We live this every day. I think they care about it tremendously. But there is also that weighing concern of there is this whole group of people. This is how they make their life. This is how they make their living. And if we get rid of this, what happens to us and to our communities? And I think those values are there as well as concern for the land and the animals.
Does your book address invasive species, cheatgrass, for example? I think at one point somewhere I read the wild horse, the Mustang, described as cheatgrass on four legs. I thought that was a great way of putting it. Obviously, there's lots of wild horses out there and a good number of people who don't think there is enough land to sustain them.
Well, that's true. They were introduced, obviously, accidentally, and to some extent they are thriving. And part of the problem when they're thriving is that there may not be enough out there in the way of feed and water to sustain the herd. So the Bureau of Land Management, that is the principal manager of all that, is faced with some awful kinds of decisions. How do you thin the herd, so to speak, so that you have a sustainable number of horses out there if you decide to keep them? And, of course, they've become an iconic image of the region and our past. So people believe, oh, those wild horses, we got to protect them. And I like wild horses. Who doesn't? But the thing is, though, that they really don't belong there in terms of an ecosystem explanation, at least that's my understanding. They can become too plentiful to survive in a humane way. And so then you're left with questions about, do we intervene to thin the herd and ensure their survival? People are really concerned about the handling of those animals because of their concern about humane treatment, which is laudable. But there is a question of now that we've got them and they've become an iconic symbol of the area, what are we going to do with them?
So if the Great Basin were a state, it would have within it these four cities which face so many challenges into the future. Because it is not a state and we have these problems divided up among three different states, it's really questionable whether or not these issues are going to get confronted at the level they need to be addressed. In light of the fact that we don't have the Great Basin state with these cities within it, is there any sign of cooperation, voluntary cooperation and collaboration at the federal government, state government level, along with local governments for that matter, getting involved to solve some of these issues and lay out a strategic plan that takes us well into the future so we don't wind up with states no longer able to serve their citizens?
Well, that's a great question. I think that some of the land management agencies, the federal land management agencies' efforts, for example, to develop a sage-grouse plan or a plan to address cheatgrass or firefighting, you know, in the region, are steps in that direction. I don't know how effective that's going to be, though, because they don't have the trust and the ear and the confidence of the governors and the state administrations, right? So they're kind of out there hoping for collaborative effort. And they are making some – there are some areas where there have been great successes, maybe a few well-placed land swaps and reclassification of land, and everybody's happy. It's a better use of the land, that kind of thing. But – this is an area that for so long we just treated like a big empty place where you could – I mean, it was so – considered so useless, we let off atomic bombs in the middle of it. So now we're coming to see this is actually environmentally a very fragile place. You know, when you think about how fragile is the desert, well, we still see the ruts of the Oregon Trail, right? And so I think that our attention to now, oh my gosh, what's going on there? It is sensitive to climate change. It is sensitive to environmental degradation and we need to act more quickly if we wish to sustain it.
Great. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
Again, the name of the book, Cities, Sagebrush, and Solitude, Urbanization and Cultural Conflict in the Great Basin, edited by Dennis R. Judd and Stephanie L. Witt, our guest today. Next week, Chad Harback, author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.